Black Agenda Radio, Mondays at 5 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, analysis, and commentary from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. My co-host Nellie Bailey is off doing the people's business elsewhere today. Coming up in this hour, Black Agenda Report's Margaret Kimberly delivers a requiem on 40 years of Harlem Congressman Charles Rangel, and Marsha Coleman Adebayo takes us on a journey to the sacrifice zone. But first, the National Peace Conference last week in Albany, New York, called for the immediate, total, and unconditional withdrawal of all U.S. troops, mercenaries, and contractors from Afghanistan, Iraq, and Pakistan, and the immediate closing of all U.S. bases in those countries. One point of contention was U.S. support for Israel. Here's Bill Doors of Al Auda, the Palestine Right to Return Coalition.
I'm happy to say it wasn't a tremendous point of contention because the conference voted overwhelmingly for a resolution. It called for an end of all U.S. aid to Israel, an end to the siege on Gaza, an end to Israel's apartheid practices against the people of Palestine, and for recognition of the people of Palestine's right to return and live in freedom in every part of their homeland. And it also called for an end to the siege on Gaza and called for support of the U.S. boat Audacity of Hope, which will be going to Gaza as part of the next Freedom Flotilla. It's been a long struggle in the anti-war movement to raise the issue of Palestine, and for decades we were told that nobody will support this or we'll lose, you know, it's any chance of support of the labor movement or Democratic Party politicians or something. The black movement was always in the vanguard on it. It was SNCC back in 1967 that took a stand against Israeli genocide and got no end of condemnation for that. But it shows it's really a tribute to the persistence of the struggle of Palestinian people and of people, activists around the world, that at this conference this weekend, we heard the same tired old arguments. In this case, it was people claiming to represent labor, who are really staff people, not elected union leaders, who said, well, if you vote for this, labor will never support you. But our view is that this war, the war going on against the people of Palestine, is every bit as much a U.S. war as the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. Every weapon of mass destruction that was rained down on Gaza last January, from the dense, inert metal explosives that sliced off children's limbs, or the white phosphorus that burns people's lungs from the inside out, and the F-16 planes and Black Hawk helicopters that fired those weapons, down to the M-16 rifles that Israeli soldiers carry, or the tear gas canister that was used to just put out the eye of a young Jewish American woman who was protesting Israeli apartheid on the West Bank. All these weapons are made in the United States, paid for by the United States, paid for by our tax dollars. And if we're serious about calling this an anti-war movement, we have to stand in solidarity with the people of Palestine and stand against the war, Israeli genocide in Palestine, every much as we've got to stand against the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I'm very happy to say that this position won overwhelmingly at this weekend's conference, and the tired old arguments were rejected.
And in fact, elements of labor have made their position against U.S. Collaboration with Israel known.
Well, the claim that we would lose labor if we took a stand against Israeli genocide and racism is false. It's not based on any rank and file sentiment from the labor movement that rank and file workers just want to give their money to Israel. It's based on the ties of certain staff people and bureaucrats to the Democratic Party. That's the same thing that took labor from taking a stand against the so-called labor, the union leaders, from taking a stand against the war in Iraq when it started. It took for years to take a stand against the war in Afghanistan. But this is the same thing that's holding these ties to the Democratic Party, are the same thing that's holding back the labor movement from waging a real struggle against layoffs and cutbacks and all the things that are coming down on workers in this country. I'm an elected union delegate, by the way. We had on our side at this conference, we had elected union leaders from a number of locals, from the teachers union in New Haven, Connecticut, to the school bus drivers union in Boston, to the New York City Technical Guild in DC 37 who were with us. And that argument didn't fly, and it's about time that people try to intimidate us from taking a stand for justice.
So finally, an important anti-war gathering takes this kind of stand. What has changed and what has remained the same over the years regarding this issue?
Well, it's become harder and harder for the U.S. and Israel to hide the crimes that are going on in Palestine. The Palestinian people's struggle will not stop. We've seen the massacre carried out in Gaza last year, the attack on the Freedom Flotilla just a few months ago when nine human rights workers were killed, including one 19-year-old U.S. citizen, and millions of people are now beginning to see through these lies, and the persistence of the movement around the world as well. You know, Nelson Mandela and Desmond Tutu have said that Israeli apartheid is worse than what happened in South Africa. COSATU, the Congress of South African Trade Unions, is taking a strong stand with the people of Palestine. Unions in Sweden are refusing to unload Israeli ships. Greece as well. In Greece, they shut down El Al Airlines. And this is the overwhelming sentiment of the people of the world based on concrete reality. You can only hide the truth for so long.
The 700 attendees at the National Peace Conference will work to shift the trillions of dollars spent on wars and corporate bailouts to massive programs for jobs, education, healthcare, housing, and the environment. And they vow to build a movement that is more inclusive of all sectors of the American people. Teresa Gutierrez of the International Action Center spoke to the issue of immigrants' rights. After that, you'll hear from yours truly, Glenn Ford, on behalf of the Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations. But first, Teresa Gutierrez.
I want to thank the organizers of this conference. We may be a little bit pigment challenged, and maybe a lot of us have gray hair, but this is a visionary event that filled a vacuum that people were hungry to come together to struggle against this war. And so I really want to thank the organizers for doing this. And as we talk about the Latino struggle, one of the most important things that the anti-war movement must pay attention to and respond to whenever we can is reactions such as the horrible killing of Oscar Grant in Oakland, California, yet another African-American brother beat down by racist police. And we must continue to fight justice for Oscar Grant. And not forget the 7-year-old child in Detroit, Ayanna Stanley Jones, who was killed by police. Another sign of the devastation and depressive conditions in Detroit, Michigan. But I want to focus now on the immigrant rights struggle, not only because this is one of the most dynamic movements in this country today, not only because over a million immigrants and their supporters marched not only on 2006, but 2010 as well, reviving May Day once again in this country, but because the attacks emanating from the White House, Wall Street, and the Pentagon also amount to a war against immigrant workers. How else could you describe the ongoing militarization of the U.S.-Mexican border? The odious racial profiling of workers of color, the painful breaking up of entire families, including leaving children alone at home when their parents have been detained, the mass incarceration of workers whose only crime was trying to survive. Since 2001, U.S. policy on immigration has been framed as a security issue. This is an attempt to demonize immigrants when it is instead a labor issue, a civil rights issue, and an issue of U.S. foreign policy. The incalculable deaths on the border, in detention centers, all amount to a vicious racist war. And that's why this conference has already come out so strong on this issue, but must continue to condemn this war on immigrants, as we condemn the ongoing wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, Palestine, Pakistan, and the threat of a new war on Iran. Nor can we forget the continuing U.S. threats against North Korea. Bring all the troops home. And you want to resolve the problems with the city? Then end all aid to Israel. That's a hell of a lot of money. As 7,000 U.S. troops land in Costa Rica, why are they there? They are there because of the revolutionary process in Bolivia and Venezuela. They are there because of the ongoing symbol of resistance that our beloved Cuban Revolution continues to play. And they are there because of the people of Honduras who have fought against the bloody coup that this government was behind. Honduras is a great example of how the immigrant question has nothing to do with foreign policy, has nothing to do except manipulation and control of workers. Because if the far right wing was really against immigrants coming here, then they would have let President Manuel Zelaya carry out the policies that he was going to do, which would have meant that Honduran workers wouldn't have forced to live, to leave. Yes. I am so glad that the organizers of this conference already agreed not to have their April actions close to May Day, because that would have been quite a problem for the immigrant rights movement. And so we must applaud the fact that the demonstrations have been moved to April 9th, because it's a good development and a revolutionary one that May Day has been revived in this country. And why? Because it widely opens up the possibility of advancing the righteous struggle for jobs, legalization, and an end to war in this country. Perhaps one of the greatest lessons from the immigrant rights movement today is that there is no way in hell that we can count on the powers that be. The stalemate has Congress, has opened up the door to SB 1070, but Arizona is no excuse for us to support the Schumer plan on immigration, and we must come out against the Schumer plan. So, I want to end there because they're telling me to stop. I just want to say, free Lynn Stewart, free Mumia Abu-Jamal, free Dr. Afia Siddiqui and all political prisoners. No war abroad, no war at home. Si se puede.
Most of us in the Black is Back coalition are confident that the movement does not need some magic wand or killer application, mostly because such things don't exist. What we do need are organizations that are willing to confront power, willing to identify who the enemy is and to call them out, to make sense of emerging realities to as many people as we can reach, and to involve as many people as possible in forceful and sustained opposition to those who do harm to the people. A real movement breeds a culture of resistance, a widely held belief that it is right to resist, that it is virtuous to speak truth to power. That culture of resistance is what made Black America the most reliably progressive anti-war demographic in the United States. It was not that Black people were smarter than anybody else. We were just less confused. We had a better and a clearer idea of who the enemy was. That was yesterday. Today, our job is exponentially more difficult because Black people, who were not too long ago the collective rock of progressivism, are more confused about some things than most everybody else. In the real world, Blacks have been pushed to an even lower level of hell by the Great Recession, on top of the previous recession. It has been an unmitigated disaster in which Blacks
have fared far worse than every other major group. But the Pew poll shows conclusively that blacks are the most upbeat about the economy of all groups, and that a large proportion actually believe that they are better off than before the Great Recession. This is madness. And this madness, this great historical anomaly, can all be explained in one word. What's the word? Obama. It turns out that Obama is the killer application for the other side. He is their secret weapon. His very presence in the White House is a narcotic, a hallucinogen that causes all of the so-called traditional base of the Democratic Party to lose contact with some degree of reality. But it is most destructive in black America. It was as this great crisis of the black American polity was unfolding that the Black Is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations came into being. It was clear to the coalition that unless and until Obama's pass is revoked in the black community, we could not be able to organize effectively. For Black Is Back, breaking the Obama spell is the must-do task for a renewed movement for social justice and for peace. And there is nothing complicated about it. You simply tell the truth. Obama works for Wall Street and the militarists. That is the truth. If we play around with these essential truths, we defeat ourselves. The definition of defeat is a black America that is asleep. Right now, there is a determined effort to use the Tea Party's white nationalist ravings to mobilize a circling of the black wagons around Obama, thus diverting attention from the fact that Obama works for Wall Street and the militarists. Those same forces will try to morph the NAACP and organized labor's October 2nd march in Washington into a rah-rah rally for Obama and the Democrats. We at the Black Is Back Coalition anticipate that this conference will endorse the October 2 march, and we agree, and we will participate unless that is made impossible. We believe that there are many NAACPs. In fact, NAACP activists have been part of the Black Is Back Coalition from the very beginning. And we believe that we should encourage those chapters and those individuals that are serious about speaking truth to power. And the same thing goes for labor. But when we march, no matter who we march with, we must speak the truth, and Obama must get no pass, because that is to give a pass to war and to Wall Street. Thank you.
You're listening to Black Agenda Radio, your indispensable weekly source of analysis, news, and commentary on the Progressive Radio Network.
Harlem Congressman Charles Rangel is facing the greatest crisis of his long career. Black Agenda Report editor and senior columnist Margaret Kimberly is one of Rangel's constituents.
After many months of rumor and investigation, the House Ethics Committee has leveled 13 charges of ethics violations against Congressman Rangel, mostly about not reporting income, also using his house stationery and staff to have a facility at City College, New York City College, named after him, and an accusation of proposing a favorable tax legislation towards the donor of this center. And as then chair of the House Ways and Means Committee, he had the power to do that. There aren't any allegations, though, of Rangel taking money of taking bribes, of anything that I generally think of as corruption. It's frankly, it's rather sad. It's about a history of sloppiness that he could ill afford to continue once he became chair of the House Ways and Means Committee, which is sad in another way. Those of us who live in Rangel's district waited for years. He had all this seniority on the committee, and when Democrats, after a 12-year wait, once again assumed the majority in 2006, he became the committee chairperson. And this impending chairmanship was treated almost as the second coming. Charlie will be chair of Ways and Means, and won't that be wonderful? Aside from his own legal problems, frankly, didn't really mean much to this district. That position didn't bring jobs, didn't bring housing, didn't stop gentrification, didn't do any of the things that people in Harlem and Washington Heights needed to have done.
Well, you know, you were talking about corruption or the absence of it or relative levels of corruption. But isn't aiding, abetting gentrification, which is not in the interests of the vast majority of your constituents, a kind of corruption?
Yes, it is a kind of corruption, and I suppose we've gotten so used to it. I didn't think of it that way when I first spoke of it. You know, over the years, as we've said many times in Black Agenda Report, the Congressional Black Caucus has changed and changed, not for the better. As corporate influence has strengthened its role in politics, and as more and more black politicians were bought off with the corporate money that ensures their continued incumbency, they stopped fighting for the things they traditionally fought for. These days we don't even get, we used to get at least lip service. Now there isn't even an appearance of fighting for constituents and for the things that they really need, like places to live, like affordable housing, like jobs. New York City has, before the recession, had a nearly 50% unemployment rate for black people. And yet, there's this expectation of Rangel achieving this very powerful position did not include any expectation of it helping his constituents in any concrete way. It's the same sort of attitude that has allowed Barack Obama to coast through without, well, on a good day he doesn't do anything for black people. On a bad day he actively works against our interests. The black face in a high place, that syndrome from days of segregation, which said that was always a good thing, that it was inherently beneficial to all, if only because it made us feel better to see a black person in a high position, whether that position benefited anyone else or not. And Rangel certainly epitomized that phenomenon.
Charles Rangel has more seniority in the Congress than any other member of the Congressional Black Caucus, except John Conyers. Has he outlived even the value of that?
Well, yes, he has. Before all this mess became publicly known, there was a question about Rangel's value to this community. And now it just makes public what anyone who had been paying attention had been seeing for a long time. Seniority should mean something. Harlem should have something that benefits us, that benefits all of us in ways that we need. There are people who, for example, we had a Senator D'Amato, a Republican for many years. He was known as Senator Pothole. a title he was very proud of because he brought home the bacon, so to speak. There were concrete things that people could point to. D'Amato brought this to the state. D'Amato brought that to the state. And Rangel could not say that. And that meant he had outlived his usefulness, in fact, a long time ago. He probably can still win, I have to say. Primaries in September. He does have an opponent who's not known to most people, who I don't see as being a viable candidate. So he can limp along and be elected again after already more than 40 years in the House, which frankly is more than long enough unless you're bringing home the bacon. But he has not for a long time. So it's sad in many ways that the expectations were never met, and it's sad for him to be going out this way, having apparently resisted for many months admitting to these charges, which frankly could have taken them off the front pages a long time ago. Most members who are charged with ethics violations admit to something and then keep their seats, and generally it's forgotten. But for reasons known only to himself, Rangel resisted doing that. And now it's close to primary time, and now this is a big story.
The Obama administration certainly wishes it had never fired Shirley Sherrod, and so does the NAACP, whose president, Ben Jealous, endorsed the dismissal of the Agriculture Department official and longtime activist on behalf of black farmers. Black Agenda Report columnist Dr. Jared Ball says the NAACP's shameful behavior is symptomatic of a deeper illness.
In the case of Shirley Sherrod, we cannot forget that the true culprit is an endemic political liberalism. It is not the right or the conservatives at Fox News. It is not the Tea Party or its media punditry. And it is certainly not some right-wing operative who keeps doctoring videos. It is a soft reformist liberal politics that is to blame. Sherrod is yet another in a procession of reasons to be disgusted by the absolute weakness of President Obama, the Democratic Party, civil rights leaders, and of liberalism itself. This is what was ultimately behind yet another black woman being publicly scorned, forcibly removed from rightful position, and blamed for all that is wrong in the world. It is a liberalism which has long frustrated true progressives. It is why Malcolm warned of the liberal fox, and King described the racial solidarity which often resulted in the liberal walking off with the aggressor. And it is why Stokely called the white liberal the weakest element of their community, whose only real purpose was to stem a more revolutionary tide. It is this self-fulfilling liberalism, a loyal opposition liberalism, that produced the conditions in which Sherrod would be condemned. Of course, it is this same liberalism which made Sherrod possible, which made Obama possible, and makes the black liberalism which supports them both. The black liberalism which is the most vile of white supremacist production. In the military, we were told that stuff rolls downhill. This meant that bad orders started at the top, picked up steam, while increasing in size and severity of impact, all culminating in a horrible crash upon those at the bottom. And in a white supremacist, capitalistic, and patriarchal society, black women, quite naturally, are that proverbial bottom upon which all society's ills fall the hardest. Shirley Sherrod was ultimately ordered to the side of the road, told to resign, and forced to pay a public and private price because of the stuff which formed at the top. It formed in the failure among us to reignite more radical movements which allowed Obama to eventually be seen as progress. It is Obama's condemnation of Reverend Wright, his refusal to attend the World Conference Against Racism, his lack of any meaningful commentary on Sean Bell, his backing down to a white cop and to an institution that routinely brutalizes black people, which ultimately supports the killing of Oscar Grant, and now James Rivera, another 15-year-old black child killed this week by police. From there, the stuff continues to roll. The NAACP makes deals with super predator Wells Fargo, accepts Obama's absence of a black agenda, and then is snookered by an already exposed media fraud into condemning Sherrod. Taking their cue from the president, who takes his own from the most liberal economic and political elite, they offer a trifling apology for what only occurred because of this fundamental liberalism. And isn't the depth of this pitiful liberalism voiced by its own language? What organization can be popular, powerful, and black with leadership that not only can be so easily snookered, but then says out of its mouth that it has been snookered? No longer are we even hoodwinked or bamboozled. You know, tricked, but strongly tricked. I suppose it's the difference between being outwitted and being without wit at all. We can't even be the more 21st century pimped. That's how soft we've become. Now we are snookered. Liberalism is our greatest problem. Not the right, not the conservative media, and not even lunatics on television who seemingly can topple a black president and the most revered civil rights organization. It is by not pressing a more sustained, public, and vigorous response to the ravages of racism in this country that liberalism has allowed for this yet another demonstration of weakness. Having mentioned one Reverend Wright felled by liberalism, let me close with the words of another Reverend Wright who warned of that very dangerous liberal tendency almost 200 years ago. In 1837, Reverend Theodore Wright made a challenge to the liberal abolitionists of his day, saying, "I fear not at all the machination, calumny, and opposition of slaveholders when contrasted with the annexation of men whose hearts have not been deeply imbued with the high and holy principles of racial equality. Remember, this prejudice must be killed or slavery will never be abolished."
Marsha Coleman Adebayo has intimate experience with racism at the highest levels of the federal government. She was fired from her post at the Environmental Protection Agency after charging pervasive racial discrimination. Her case led to passage of the No Fear Act, outlawing retaliation against federal employees who blow the whistle on discrimination. In two recent articles for Black Agenda Report, Ms. Coleman Adebayo argued that both Shirley Sherrod and the entire Gulf of Mexico have been relegated to what she calls sacrifice zones.
Sacrifice zone, by definition, if you use the Department of Energy's definition, a sacrifice zone is a place that no longer has economic or political value that can be discarded. And basically, it's almost has a conservation concept, but in sort of a deprivation sense. In other words, it's a place that's been used up and has no more use within the context of economy or politics or humanity, for that matter. And so, it's generally used to represent like an economic zone, like at a nuclear site. But I've tried to use this term not only to retrofit this term, not only just to talk about environmental disasters, but also to talk about a place in the political sphere where people can go, or people are taken, in which the people in power have decided that they are of no more use to them, and have decided that whether they live or whether they die is really of no consequence to the polity anymore, and therefore they can be sacrificed at will. And so it's an interesting, I think, paradigm, because to a large extent, you know, capital and capitalism forces us into these kinds of cost-benefit analysis of at what point is something worth whatever that item is more than a human life. And so, for example, when I worked at the EPA and I worked in the Office of Pollution Prevention and Toxics, where we use, you know, this concept a lot, cost-benefit analysis, to what extent, for example, if you use a particular chemical and you know that there are going to be side effects, at what point is the cost worth the benefit of that chemical? And if you look at that equation strictly from a humanist perspective, that even one person is not worth the cost of a particular chemical, then you often run into problems. Particularly if you're looking at, this concept, I would say, is particularly used in communities of color, where people have less benefit in terms of the way people in power see them, or Native American people, for example. And so I decided, why don't we retrofit this concept of a sacrifice zone to, you know, let's extrapolate that term to the political environment. And so that's the manner in which I'm using that term.
And how did Shirley Sherrod fail the cost-benefit analysis test and fall into the sacrifice zone?
You know, there's an African proverb that says, when two elephants fight, the grass gets hurt. And I think Shirley Sherrod, in essence, was the grass. And the two elephants, one elephant, of course, was the Obama administration, and its corollaries, like the, you know, its partners, the NAACP and other Secretary of Agriculture and other people like that. And then you had, sort of the right wing. And so you had these two elephants that were, so in a sense, you know, going at each other. And the person that they were using, both of them, was Shirley Sherrod. She became sort of the pawn for the Obama administration, from my analysis, because they wanted to show that they were prepared to sacrifice a black person who had misspoken, or who they wanted to deem as, you know, making racist statements. The right wing, of course, wanted to use her because the NAACP had made these comments about the Tea Party and in a sense, a surrogate for the White House in many ways, I would presume. And so you had these two fairly huge institutions going at each other, and then you had Shirley Sherrod. And what becomes interesting, of course, and this always happens when you have, you know, arrogant political polities going at each other, is they underestimated the kind of willpower this woman would demonstrate in the face of these two elephants, in a sense, going at each other. And she refused to die. She refused to sit there and be shredded and distorted and taken apart. The political system is actually quite used to doing that, because in the federal government, as you read in my article, we have maybe 30,000 lawsuits that are filed every year against the federal government by federal employees. And only 2% of the total number of federal employees who will file lawsuits will ever see the inside of a courtroom. So 98% of those people are generally shredded. That's a fairly large number of people. But the federal government has what I call a playbook that has been instrumental in not only helping managers understand how to undermine the rights of employees, of workers, but also how to cause a whole system essentially to cave in on an employee who was considered at that point disloyal. And so there was no reason, I suppose, from the perspective of the White House and from the perspective, you know, of the right wingers, to think that this woman was going to be able to raise her head and fight back. It's fairly unusual. And so I just assumed that they thought that they were just going to run over her and she was going to die an unnatural death in the process. But, of course, that's not what happened, and we should all applaud her for standing up and not allowing either the White House or the Department of Agriculture or the right-wingers to count her out for dead.
So from the cost-benefit analysis perspective, the White House believed there was no cost in getting rid of Shirley Sherrod, in sacrificing her.
Exactly, because the reality is that that is what the federal sector is involved in every single day, is basically shredding human beings like Shirley Sherrod. I think what happened to her, you know, it's not only unusual, it's almost a miracle. Because in the entire time that I've been fighting the federal government, which is now close to 12 years, I have never seen the government, I've never seen this kind of behavior before. Most employees don't have the option of thinking about a presidential phone call and saying, I'm sorry for what I've done to you, or that kind of media attention. Most employees barely make it through the EEO stage before they're just totally shredded. Many commit suicide, families fall apart. It takes between 5 years and 10 years to get to court, if you ever get to court. It is warfare from the moment you file a complaint until the time your complaint is resolved, however that is. It is warfare. And most people don't prevail. And they, in fact, our experience is that most people are shredded in the process. And so there was no reason to believe that this would be any different from the Obama administration perspective. or from the right-wing perspective. And so I think they were both shocked when this woman said, you know, I refuse to be led down the road, this road, and she decided to fight back.
Now, the Obama administration said, seemed to be saying, that it had zero tolerance for instances of racial discrimination, which was then vouchsafed for by the NAACP in their rush to endorse the firing. What do you think about the administration's maintenance that it does not tolerate racial discrimination?
It flies in the face of what's happening with the Obama administration. As I said in the Black Agenda article, the president need only look around his cabinet table to, in particular, one person who has a jury verdict against her for discrimination and retaliation and sexism, and that's the energy czar, so-called Carol Browner. One of the reasons why, from my perspective, they didn't nominate Carol Browner for a congressionally appointed position was because they knew they could not get her through the congressional process because of the kind of behavior she displayed when she was at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. There were demonstrations in the street because of Carol Browner. It was a hotbed of racism. One of the stories that's often quoted, just to give you an idea of the environment within EPA, when Carol Browner was head of the EPA, was a colleague of mine went on a trip with her to, I think it was Wisconsin, it was a trip on Indian territories, and her supervisor went to her and said, you know, the administrator is coming tomorrow, and she doesn't like to use the toilet behind other people. And so we need for you to go in and to clean Carol Browner's toilet, because she doesn't use the bathroom after other. This is a white supervisor to a black woman who was on a mission, who was staffing the EPA administrator. That is the kind of environment that was produced. That was the kind of environment that African Americans worked in at the EPA under Carol Browner. She gave sanction to that kind of behavior. And white managers did not feel as though they had anything to fear because they knew that that was the political culture that was engendered by her administration. When the black, after this woman, you know, performed these duties because she knew if she didn't, she would get fired, and it's a really tragic story, she actually went to Carol Browner's office with a statement saying, this is, I just want you to know what happened to me, because maybe you didn't know. This is what happened to me while I was on a mission with you, and I'm sure if you understand it, then you will make amends, you will talk to the manager, you'll have the manager fired, whatever. But I'm sure you will not allow this to stand. And Carol Browner, and she hand-walked this to her, Carol Browner never responded to her letters and to her pleas until it became public. And then at that point, she tried to say, well, you know, maybe we need to have an investigation. And the same thing happened to me where, you know, I walk into a meeting, a senior staff meeting, and I'm called, and my colleagues tell me that the reason why they feel comfortable with me is because they consider me an honorary white man. And when I reached out to Carol Browner, because she and I worked together very closely on the UN China conference, and I told her what happened. I mean, absolutely not. That was the culture within the EPA, and African Americans were expected to tolerate it and just get along. So you can imagine my surprise after I had, you know, like so many other people, marched all over Virginia and held fundraisers for Barack Obama and had made my contribution in terms of getting him elected. You can imagine my surprise when he chose someone. It wasn't a rumor that she was, you know, had administered a racist agency. We had a court victory which said that a jury has found it, that your agency is racist. And then, of course, what he did was he skirted around the Constitution and selected her to be the energy czar. I thought that set the tone, quite frankly. early on for his administration.
So there is a high tolerance for racism in this administration.
I think there's an extremely high tolerance for racism at the administration, and there are stories like mine that abound throughout the administration. So one would ask, you know, why? why should an African American tolerate this kind of racism? And I think it's because the people we're talking about represent various interests. And Carol Browner and other people like her represent what I call the envirotocracy, which is really sort of a partnership between environmentalism and private businesses. And I think we see that same kind of interplay in the playing out in the Gulf, you know, where you have BP using, you know, Corexit, you know, a chemical, a substance that's been banned in Europe because of its toxicity, and the EPA politely asking BP to please stop using it. And BP says, no, we're not going to stop using it. And then the EPA does not come back with major fines and even, you know, all the various tools at the disposal of the EPA administrator to stop a corporation that is breaking the law. And of course, you know, this particular chemical was actually has the properties that help sort of masquerade the oil that was floating at the top. It has a way of sort of, it disperses the oil so that you really can't see it floating at the top. And so at what point do you realize that we have a very sort of illicit relationship between the EPA and BP in terms of hiding the amount of oil that was actually being dispersed by the, you know, at that point. So I think that that's one of the real problems that a lot of people find themselves who work for agencies like the EPA. It's this very cozy relationship between the private sector and the agency.
So you were speaking of not just in this administration, but a federal bureaucracy workforce that is and historically has been rife with discrimination. This gave birth then to the No Fear Coalition. Of which you are a moving force. Tell us about that.
The No Fear Coalition came out of my lawsuit, which was a very visible and very sort of public fight within the agency, quite frankly. And it was the first time, I think, that the agency realized more towards the end as opposed to the beginning that this was not going to be the same old, we're just going to shred her and she's going to die on the vine. At some point, I think the agency realized that we were trying to politicize what was going on in the agency. And interestingly enough, the methods they tried to use to discourage me, of course, was what I consider like, you know, sort of private terror, you know, calling me and saying that, you know, if I put my – I'd have these phone calls that I would get at my desk at EPA, and the voice would say on the line, you know, don't be surprised when you go to your car in the evening and you put your foot on the accelerator, you get a big bang. Or I'd walk into my office and it was clear that my computer had been corrupted, you know, compromised. You know, I would, you know, in the evening, you know, I'd get a phone call in my home and someone would say, do you know where your kids are? Because your son has on a red top and your daughter has on blue jeans, and my kids are playing in front of my house.
This is these are crimes. These are terrorist threats. Of crimes that are answerable in tens of years in prison.
Well, unfortunately, the EPA, I won my case because the jury was as outraged as I hear in your voice. And when people found out what I was going through, and then things even intensified more, if you can believe it, when I was, that happened the closer I sort of got to trial, quite frankly, when it was clear that I had a really good case and I had a chance of winning. So the intimidation was accelerated. But prior to that, before that happened, I was actually the EPA representative to the White House on what was called the Gorembeki Commission, which was the U.S.-South Africa Binational Commission And my job was to work with the South African government in terms of their transitioning to a post-apartheid era and to share with them the lessons that we had learned in the United States in terms of environmental protection. And as a part of that process, I started working with various black organizations and grassroots organizations. And I was told initially, you know, don't bother with them. You know, why don't you work with these other people? And they were all Afrikaners, quite frankly. And I just sort of dismissed that and decided that if I'm the U.S. liaison to the White House and if I'm representing the EPA, then I should work with the new South African leadership. I later found out that there were, and that's what the book will detail, a lot of backroom discussions happening with these Afrikaners that were going on at this time. But I found out in this process that there was a community that was about 2 hours from Pretoria that was being exposed to the mining process to a substance called vanadium pentoxide. And it's one of the most, it's a horrible exposure. It's one of the most devastating exposures I've ever seen. And I've seen a lot, and it's really quite bad. The victims, after a very short period of time, the first symptom, I think, within maybe 2 or 3 months, is that the men become impotent. And that's a really major issue in a really poor community where quality of life issues are always being compromised. And then second of all, they start, their tongues turn green, a bright green when they're working with the substance. And these men, they try all kinds of things to try to get the green off their tongue. They'll take a spoon and try to scrape the green off the tongue. And then they start bleeding from almost every orifice of the body, the eyes, the ears, the genitals. And then sometimes they'll wake up in the morning and the vanadium will be oozing out of their skin and their sheets will have turned black from the vanadium. So I found out about this through one of the projects that I have. We had brought some environmental justice activists to the United States to sort of expose them to some of our research, and I had taken them to my alma mater, which is MIT, and to Howard University, which I had some contacts there, to sort of get a sense of what we had to offer in the United States. And this one person stepped forward and said, do you understand what's going on in South Africa? And, of course, I had never heard about this before. And when I started asking questions about this substance and the U.S. multinational corporation that was managing this plant, I was literally told by my supervisor to shut up. I mean, I couldn't believe it when shut up. I don't want to, you know, don't talk about it. Don't just shut up. And then she went on to say to me, which I thought was equally as sort of crazy, she said, look, you just got this brand new office. It's a big, beautiful office. Why don't you spend your time decorating your office instead of talking to me about these people dying from this substance or these people getting sick? And I remember just plopping in a seat and saying, what did you say to me? I mean, I couldn't believe it. And then I started asking other people, what do you know about this substance? I went to a toxicologist, and as it turns out, the symptoms that the miners and this representative was detailing to me was exactly what was noted in the toxicology accounts of exposure to this substance. And so then I started writing memos and saying, you know, as the United States government, what is our responsibility when we find out that a U.S. corporation is murdering a community? Do we have a responsibility to try to intervene at that point? And I kept getting the same answer, which is, this is not your problem. Just back off and don't deal with it. Eventually, I obviously couldn't stop talking about it and couldn't stop dealing with it. And they, you know, dismissed me from that position. And then I sort of started my nomadic journey through EPA where I was, you know, posted to one position where I was supposed to just sit there and read newspapers all day to another position. And eventually I organized a group of girlfriends who were medical doctors, and we went to South Africa on our own, you know, on our own dime, on our own money. And we started carrying out our own research, our own interviews with vanadium victims. And what we learned was 100% worse than what I knew in the United States. And so then I started writing about the plight of vanadium victims. And the responsibility that the United States has to make this right.
This is a far cry from zero tolerance.
This is a very far, far cry from zero tolerance. And what's really sad, of course, is that nothing happened. When they removed me, the issue, in a sense, died. And so these Vanadium victims are still dying in South Africa.
Marsha Coleman Adebayo, the newest member of the Black Agenda Report team. And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. I'm Glenn Ford. My co-host, Nellie Bailey, returns next week. Our thanks to the good people at Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Caitlin Fitzgerald.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.